Trader Ferg, good evening to you. How are you, my friend?
Good, Andy. Thank you for having me back on. It's always
Thanks.
fun.
Yeah, it is. It's always fun, and thanks for coming on. I was mentioning to you off camera, if there's a contrarian that I know, it would be you. And I know a lot of them, but you're a deep contrarian here. So what I'd like to do is first just work out your process and then the pain that contrarians, deep contrarians really kind of have to go through. And then I want to talk to you about what you're seeing here that's of really deep value. And it seems like all asset prices are somewhat on the rise, on the move. But what are you seeing in deep value? And then let's talk also about energy. The last time we talked was energy, if you still like that sector. And obviously petroleum hasn't really moved, but uranium's had a good bounce here. But yeah, but let's start with you and your process and the pain that contrarians have to feel.
So my process is really borrowed from my mentor, Brad McFadden, and that was just a so I came across his work when I was like I was still in corporate world. I was in asset management, but I hadn't really found a style that fitted the way I viewed the world. And when I came across him and what he was the way he was talking about investments, yes, that's I sort of do believe there's a certain amount of like your emotional makeup fits you to a style. And I was like hopeless with like Forex and futures and stop losses. And I've kind of got a just my personality. I'm not that emotional. And when I find something, I love digging into it and then I like cling to it for dear life. And so that kind of fitted me to like kind of bombed out hated areas. I loved the fact that it like no one loved it and that I could see why it could turn around. And if I position size correctly, like it kind of worked in my favor, kind of being stubborn and trying to see a position through, whereas that's kind of deaf if you're trading futures, like clinging to positions when you got leverage and whatnot. So that's how I kind of found my way into it. Brad sort of imparted all his principles and then I kind of ran with him with my own style. We still chat regularly and yeah, we've kind of involved in different sectors and kind of come at stuff differently now. But overall, yeah, his process was his sort of principles was really guided me to how I view the market. And I was quite lucky with just kind of the way social media took off as well. Like I was trading my own account for a long time. I kind of left my job and just traded full time. And then kind of it's kind of a lonely game as well. And so that was when I started my first Twitter account during COVID. And that's when everyone was staring at screens and kind of worked out there's actually a great community out there as well. And that's it's been hugely beneficial to meet all the experts in every area. Like I'm just a generalist and yet I can kind of reach out to, I don't know, someone like Matt Water and Cole and be like, this is what I'm seeing. This is my hypothesis. Is this what you're seeing with your like decades of knowledge in the sector, and I'm just like just putting two and two together and ask them. And then I love doing that. I love having someone that I really respect in each area that I can just bounce it off. And I've got all my sort of rules of thumb that I bring to it as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I started this journey right after COVID, if you were. I was always a trader slash investor, if you would. But what I found out, and I'm glad you said that, is I'm not the subject matter expert. All my listeners and out there viewers, I'm not the subject matter expert, but I want to talk to the person that's the subject matter expert because there's so much learning and putting me on the right path, if you would. And I just highly enjoy that. So I can really relate. You mentioned Matt Warder, who's a fantastic, just a great guy, number one.
He's lovely. Yeah.
I love him and I'll get him on again. Yeah, I think he's probably the authority, and you put me onto him as I think about it. He's probably the authority, I think, in coal. And who thinks of coal? No one, right? Or very little few people. I'm bringing that up. Is that still an asset area that you're interested in? It's had a good bounce. Man, it sold off until the spring, but it's had a bounce here. Are you still, I guess, is that looking into your, I guess, your view of the world and assets?
Yeah, and I still like Cold. Like I have still have a decent amount of exposure to it. I've kind of got a whole thesis that we're going to see a boom in Asia and coal will benefit from that. The problem with coal is finding decent ways to play it because with some of the companies that I've historically like the likes of Whitehaven, even more recently, like Yarn Coal, is that they're in Australia and they can't help but get kind of caught up in politics. Like you've had the pretty nasty royalty regime put on coal where it's all tiered levels and that kind of stuffs up the economics a bit. And then more recently, you've had Australia talking of a 5% cash flow tax, which would hit them again, and Australia pushing forward with net zero, which I ultimately see that sort of blowing out energy costs, and then they'll look to subsidize it. And if coal's doing well, then that'll be a sort of an easy target again. So that's the only dampener on the coal thesis is where to look. You've got some interesting plays in Indonesia, but then they're quite hard to access because a lot of the brokers don't give you Indonesian access to the Indonesian markets. Some of the US names are really interesting. Like I'm a big fan of the likes of Warrior. I just think that's got a great story, and it's kind of underappreciated how much extra capacity they're going to bring on with Blue Creek. So yeah, no, I'm still a fan of coal. I just think it's a longer term thesis. Tough to go too wrong when you're getting in with these prices and like the valuations you get in that. But yeah, it can. I think you've got to go in there with a longer term time frame and also be careful of like the sort of inherent geopolitical risk. And it's not only sort of the African risk, it's the kind of developed country risk with Australia, which is kind of that's been frustrating there.
Yeah. It's interesting to take a little bit of step back. You can be early, I guess, but it's really, I think what I like about one of the things that I think is very interesting about you and you do well is portfolio management. And that makes up for a lot of things, if you would, portfolio. And you mentioned, like, for example, with coal and some of the different companies in the different countries. Talk to me a little bit. How do you handle portfolio management in the context of the different commodity sectors, if you would, and even leverage? Do you even use leverage at all?
No, so I never use leverage. And yeah, it's an important point because portfolio management is literally the key to like long-term success in this game. And so how you size positions is one of the biggest sort of factors in like you like I didn't I still think I'm like working on it till today. Like I keep adjusting it and I'm forever learning from past mistakes. Like I found out I had correlations I didn't think I had, and everything kind of moves together. But my overall framework is I try and break it down between sectors, like a sort of a, it never works out this way, but a rough framework would be maybe four different sectors, and each of them would be roughly a quarter. And then within each of those quarters, it would be maximum sort of 5% per company or position. And normally it's, I usually size positions 2-3%, and then if I have a lot of conviction, I move it up to 5. And that's probably the more important point, is because I think there's a real art to making sure you cover your downside. So it's really hard to come back from when you get your ass handed to you, and in this game, you generally do get your ass handed to you on something that's hard to see. Like if you, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a. So something like if you're going global atomic and then you have the coup and then just get really like rug pulled on something like that over long term, you've got to manage that downside. And yet you want to have enough on the table that when it works, it really moves the needle. So it's fine to say sort of just 1% positions, but that if you nail sort of a 10 bagger on a 1% position, doesn't move the needle that much, like 10% extra to the portfolio. Whereas if it's a sort of that 3%, it's kind of the sweet spot because now you're adding a third to your portfolio, which is really moving the needle. And obviously, if you've got real conviction and push it up to the 5%, then if you're getting up those high returns, you're really moving the needle with the portfolio. So I kind of call that there's like the sort of downside protection, and yet there's on the other side there's like the regret minimization, also I guess opportunity cost of having something that works, because you do need those winners to sort of compensate for so the dumb stuff that is I'm inevitably going to do over time. Yeah. And then from there it's And then from there it's trying to kind of break down the correlation between some of the sectors. Like something dumb that I did was just kind of think that offshore drillers and uranium kind of had different drivers, but when came to it, they just moved exactly the same and had a pretty identical drawdown in both of them. Whereas it's always nice when you got some positions that just move to a completely different beat, like a sort of like Chinese tech has got nothing to do with commodities, or got one position, rhodium, and it's fairly large position. And sometimes I pull, I don't know if you use on a MacBook, you've got the stocks and you can swipe across and see all the tickers. And it's just a sea of red, and that thing will be green. Like it doesn't care what the broad market's doing. And so it's lovely to have positions like that that are really sort of break the correlation down.
Yeah,
because it's easy to, before you know it, to suddenly have a book that's all just following one correlation. Yeah, which if it's been an energy, it's been pretty painful.
Yeah. So I talked to all my viewers and listeners about that. Is I think portfolio management, anybody, you can get lucky picking a stock and then you think you won the world, or you won the Olympics or whatever. But I think so much of long, if you want longevity in investment or trading or whatever your style is, portfolio management and construction is so, so key to all of this, just to managing risk. Let me ask you this. When do you typically sell? I mean, when do you take money off the table? And I think there's a tension there because you want to let the winners ride, yet you also, again, want longevity, and you want it, this tension of greed, if you would.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Yeah. So this is like, talking about stuff that's forever evolving. Like I've just had a constantly changing view on this. Like for uranium, I wrote full exit pieces originally, like every note that I'd sell down. And well, it all sounds great in theory, and I still kind of believe that when you're applying that with certain companies, they can make it very hard to kind of like, that assumes that a company's going to remain continue executing, meeting guidance, and going to be a decent vehicle over the duration of that. And with uranium in particular, it's been very hard to hold a lot of these companies because they just inherently have run into so many issues, particularly the sort of early stage producers. Mm-hmm. And so something I've learned is just, I think there's certainly a point at which when you've had a good return, it's just gradually trimming into superior risk rewards at all times. It's to never let a position get too large, because there is a I've often quoted, there's a book called The Art of Execution, and it was a guy, Lee Freeman Shaw, and he was a fund of fund managers, and he oversaw dozens and dozens of fund managers, and he categorized them all into different attributes. He had like the rabbits that just, when they had a drawdown, they put their head in the sand and hope for the best. And he noticed that the ones that made all the money, he'd call them connoisseurs, and they'll be the ones that could spot an opportunity, size it up, and really ride it, and almost be sort of lazy at taking profits. He said they'd just gradually trim it. And I sort of adopted that style, with a problem with some of the stuff I look at is when it gets really large, they're actually really poor quality businesses. So you don't want them to get that large. And so I think something I thought was just trimming gradually. Whenever you feel good about something, you should probably be trimming it and putting it into something that feels hopeless. I've always found that interesting in my portfolio. Often the positions I feel the most strongly will work are often the ones that disappoint me, whereas the ones that I feel are the most hopeless often are the ones, like my own gut instinct towards it, like, oh, this won't work. I recently had it where I wrote a long piece on seismic, and I kind of had this whole spiel about how if you go into these companies like seismic exploration for oil, you're going to have to go in with a 5-year time frame And that's the time frame that they'll actually start to work. And of all things, both of them are pretty much up like 100% within like a month or two. It's just it's almost that joke of when like it's actually easy to make money when the expectations are just in the shitter. Like they're just absolute bottom rung. And so any slight improvement on the outlook and yeah, it jumps up. And that's often the way sort of serious multi-baggers work is it's like you just blink and they're up sort of a they're a double or a triple, and it's just you've but going hand in hand with that is can be like when you're going into that sort of thing, you can be early by a few years. And I've definitely had a few of those in my sort of investing experience where I go in and got nothing to show for a few years of holding something.
It's funny you say that too, because I try to do a self-analysis, well, all the time, but when I'm feeling really good, I'm trying to condition, or I've tried to condition myself over the years. That's when I have to be the most careful, if you would, and not lean into that feeling, if you would. And when I'm in a position and there's so much despair, even my own despair, or it's just utter crap, I try to lean into that, but that can't be the only reason I'm leaning into it, if that makes sense. There has to be other reasons. Does this change my thesis, or what? Why am I feeling this way? And if nothing's changed, that's typically a sign of the bottom. And I think I'm like everybody else, if you would. So.
Well, what you're saying is such a key observation. So I'm just reading a book that's The Money Game, and it's just a simple point that human that markets are just mass human psychology. And so a lot of the moves that you see, it actually really helps you if you just think about that as the bottom was in when the last person that thought they had an iron stomach sells, and the top is in euphoria when the last person kind of got dragged in. And if you think about that person, like the Yeah, it's fascinating when you kind of think about that. It's just mass behavior. There's not that's all it is, and it like the majority of this game is just controlling yourself emotionally. And a lot of what we think sounds smart is just attaching a narrative to something after it's started to work. It's not actually yeah. There's an awful lot of like sort of post analysis of why something has happened.
Right. And then becomes like circular. Well, hey, I'm really smart because I thought of this and this and this, and this is why it moved. And of course, it's going to move higher because I think of this and this and this. And I've come to the point where that might be true. Sure. And it might be crap. It's just moving because it should move. You know, yeah, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, Brad and I had this chat, I think, this month, and it was along the lines of probably one of the better some of the better trades have been when you actually go into something that it's hard to even articulate a bullish argument because it's that hated. It's like there is it's not even that easy to say why it should turn around on any meaningful time frame. And that's if you can't even fish up a bullish argument, it probably means there's almost no one there. And if you've just seen improving business fundamentals is what I'm doing at the moment, where I'm finding a lot of value. I'm just hunting in a lot of Asia, looking in markets that just largely aren't touched by any sort of serious capital flows. I'm talking like companies that are the last two, three companies I've bought have been last two can two of the last three companies I've bought have been when I bought them, they were sub $50 million market caps, and they were just tiny, hated, on small exchanges. Never haven't had the most recent one hasn't obviously had any hasn't been touched by any sort of US passive flows or benefited from that in any way. And I've seen a few more that I find interesting. Like one at the moment's Thailand, and it's like trying to even get access to this stuff. Like IB doesn't even give you access to Thailand and in Indonesia, so then you have to open a separate broker, which is something I'm kind of increasingly embracing because like I think we have a real bubble at the moment, and I think there could be some real carnage if the whole passive flows goes into reverse. And so the
Right.
idea of hanging out in areas where this particular tie company, it's like trading half its market cap's cash. It's like EVs two times. And if you look at the revenue, it's shooting the lights out. Lovely chart. Like, it's just this sort of stuff. Like, I don't understand how you go too wrong with it. And it's just bloody hard to access. Like, I have to open a whole different brokerage to get access to it. And so I see a scenario where you just haven't seen absolute carnage in the US, and I'm like collecting the, it's got a 10%, 9% dividend as well. So just collecting my dividend and experiencing nice capital gains, because you're like sheltering from the storm in some little forgotten market that hasn't seen any serious capital inflows for over a decade.
You know, that's such a great point too, because I think that's probably why they don't have capital flows, is because it's in a market that nobody's interested in at the moment. And you have to open up another brokerage and all of that. I think if you just, that's the lesson. If you just do the work, and the work is in the details, meaning work is just signing more paperwork and transferring money around, doing something that nobody else is willing to do. And then, but hanging out in something that people, it's either forgotten or just unwanted. I mean, that should get everybody's interest, or yours and my interest. Talk about some sectors, though, because it seems like everything is in a bubble. It's hard for me to see value, I guess, relative to where everything's at. And it's interesting, specifically in the gold and silver market, because I'm heavy in that market. I haven't. And I'm, for all, this is not a brag, I say this with humility, I'm up a lot. But I'm nervous, right? Because... yeah, I still see these things being, I haven't gotten 10 baggers yet as in last year, but I've gotten a lot of 2, 3, 4 baggers in, but it's making me nervous, but I still see significant upside value. But there's that tension that we were talking about. And then I look through the whole spectrum, the only, and these are just my thoughts, not yours, and I want to get them. The only deep value I really see is in oil. And I don't even know how deep a value that is.
Yeah, well, so there's a few things to touch on there. Like with gold, I think that's just the start of a monster trend. Like, I think it is still hated in that you just look at the inflows into the actual mine of vehicles, and it's still like I own GDXJ, and it's been heavy outflows up until recently. I think it's had inflows in the last week or two. Yeah. Yeah, and so that's like
that's a bullish sign. Outflows, yet it's still going up.
yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, what happens when people actually start getting interested in it again? Like, and give up on their. I kind of find it fascinating. If we go, I've kind of got a view that we're going to end up with decently high inflation again. And I'm kind of wondering how much of what would have flowed into sort of junior mining space has been sidetracked by sort of trading crypto and whatnot, and how crypto, besides like Bitcoin, I get Bitcoin, but the rest of the crypto space, like how is that going to hold up in sort of high inflation? And ultimately sort of all the junior mining space has got to plug a whole lot of deficits across the commodity space, because I don't know if anyone's aware, but like I think it was back in like the late 90s, the junior mining space was, I think it was 50% of the overall mining sector, and now it's down to sub 20, and it's just... yeah, just completely shrunk. And yeah, like just the nature of commodities is you consume them and have to replace your reserves over time. And it does need investment. Like, I'm very aware of that with even something like uranium. That's just, like you just know the demand's coming down the pipeline and you know there isn't enough. And so, yeah, I think it's one of those trends, especially with gold and gold miners. You almost want to, you want some sort of volatility so you can take advantage of it, because you know that's just going to be a monster trend. So you should almost be wanting to see some drawdowns to give you a chance to add. But as you point on energy, I think energy is just, I think it's going to be the largest outperformer for the next decade. And it's just the fact that everyone hates it, even my own subscribers. Like, it's interesting when you just start to see people just say, well, like, yeah, there's I don't want to throw in the towel on it. Just be like, this has been such a dog. I've got one joke in my I have a friend that I message on energy, and he's like, do you believe this? And it was it's a picture of like the oil positioning is at a 16 year low, and then we hadn't talked for a few months, and then said any updates on energy. And I'd actually just seen this, the exact same chart, and the only update on it was it's now at a 17-year low. So it's just all they've done is put a new title on it and a new axis, and it had dropped again, and so gone back another year. And I was like, no, that's the only update, is it's just got more of a funeral for sentiment. But it's ultimately understanding the stuff's all cyclical. And I had a really interesting piece I send out like a weekly email in Ferg's Finds, and it's just the idea that energy is like, I've always loved Vaclav Smil's books. He's like the godfather of energy. He's this guy that's kind of right. Between him and Charles Hoare, who kind of came up with the energy return on investment sort of whole theory. And what Vaclav, one of my favorite quotes of him is that it's just, you can't talk about sort of economic growth and energy like separately, like they're the same thing, it's tautology. And we've kind of forgotten that. And there's been a lot of assumptions made on just abundant energy when it was really, it's a period of time where we had like China just going through the roof with coal, coal production consumption, and then the shale boom, which was largely fueled by like cheap money.
Mm-hmm.
And come off the back of that, it's I think energy is could get back up to sort of its not its highs, but it as a sort of a percentage of the S&P or something could get up into the teens again, whereas now it's, I think it's even pushed back below 3%, whereas the other side of it's obviously just the sheer valuations the likes of AI gets. And with AI, for me, I almost view it like a commodity. It's just like, I find that like some of the like the simplest observations, like if I run out of credits on ChatGPT Plus, I just jump over to Grok 4. Like I just jump between all the different. So I don't right. think they've got any real monopoly. They've got no ability to really monetize me. Whereas like I realize where I'm being like cornered, like Google with their with my email and my whatever it's called work. Station, like they just tell me they're increasing pricing. I don't even check the increase because I know they've got me. Like I've got all my Google Drive and Google Gmail. Like I'm stuck in their ecosystem. The same as like when my MacBook breaks, I just walk into Apple and give me another one. Like I don't really, they could keep pricing it up because they've got me captured. Whereas I don't see how there's any return ever with AI. So I view it as a commodity, and I think it'll follow that commodity cycle. And there'll be a boom and there'll be a bust. And I think energy is kind of the other side of that. And
You know, it's if you compare the two, I'll go to gold and energy. I would agree with you too, if you look at the macro. And I want to say this correctly. You don't want to say it's different this time, right? But the point is, you can make money on a really good trend. That's gold. And there's reasons for that really good trend. And also, and these are my opinions, I don't want to speak for you, the miners are still very relatively undervalued. So I think there still is a great value there relative to the price of gold. I mean, I talk to gold mining presidents, executives all the time for these smaller stocks, and they're just, the producers are just printing money at these prices, literally. So that's one way to make money. There's still great value, but yet I still have that tension, if you would. Man, I'm up so much. Am I feeling too good? I guess it's just self-reflection and looking at yourself here. But I'm fighting that, if you would. But then you have the other spectrum where I see energy being so hated, if you would. And you just mentioned the update of the chart was that it was lower. But instead of I think that's something, again, for myself, again, looking at myself, that is something I want to lean into. And I just lean into by getting really good companies that are very cash flow positive, have a lot of cash flow, and have really low multiples in their PE ratios. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, like what you summed up. So almost like this whole thing is like knowing yourself as well. And when you feel really good about something, like I've often joked with friends, like if you ever feel the need to take a screenshot of your portfolio, you should probably immediately like trim that position and put put something into something that just like, yeah, you feel sick about. Like, and all my trades that have made me the highest returns, I was like, didn't feel great putting them on. I was just like, oh, this is doesn't make sense. It's not comfortable. It would be easier to put it into something that's working. But it's, yeah, your kind of emotions work against you in that way. And that's it's just human nature. It's fighting that with a lot of this. Granted, yeah, I don't think you'll go too wrong gold. I'm not telling you to sell your gold miners. I think that, yeah, that is such an interesting trend. Because I kind of, if it's going to be wrong on energy, it'll be on the back of Luke Roman's view that the gold to oil ratio is just going to blow out to all new all-time highs. And that's going to be on the back of gold kind of being used to recap the system. And you've kind of seen it to an extent, is that a lot of the developing countries are net settling in gold. So they like trade sort of rubles for renminbi and then net settle in gold or with any of the other sort of developing countries just to have that. And so that the gold market needs to expand to allow that. And that's just going to continue to create this underlying bid for gold. And that's what's the interesting thing with gold is that, as we were discussing before, there's no retail interest in it at all. This is all
Right.
largely driven by central banks and developing markets to a lesser extent. And that's, yeah, that's the kind of tailwind you want. You want, you've got all the tailwinds you need with gold. The only thing I sort of observe gold is that it has moved, and there's a lot of stuff that I think will play catch up. And that's where you can have sort of Broman's view. I've actually written a piece on this because it was the one sort of question that annoyed me. Like I just wanted to kind of, like whenever a question annoys me, I want to write about it and get all my thoughts down. And if you look in previous bull markets like the 70s, like gold generally has led, and then a lot of the rest of the commodity space will play catch up. And so whereas gold might sort of do nothing for a period. And so you could have something like gold's up like 200%, and then oil does something crazy, like sort of in the third year that was similar to the 70s. And yeah, you almost I like I called Kevin, a guy called Kevin Brammer, and he called it like playing whack-a-mole with the portfolio. He said you just always keep an eye on what's the most attractive sort of demand supply and something that's about to go. And if commodity space, it will always be something that's on the verge of it will be sort of hated, and yeah, the supply demand will be quite compelling. And so you'll always observe sort of rolling breakouts. And I think that's what we'll have this time as well. I don't see sort of an event where everything just runs together. And yeah, guess.
Well, let's tell me just real quick, and we'll land the plane on this. You mentioned going into an inflationary time, and we're already there, really. What is your really view, and how is that really moving forward over the next several years, and how is that affecting your investment strategy?
Yeah, so I think this is the biggest, like, if you just back up, like with the by looking at the US like financial situation, it's kind of clear where this is heading. Like it's with the deficit, we've tried the austerity. Like there's really only three options: is austerity, default, or print the difference, essentially. And tried austerity for a little period with Doge, and everyone sort of saw how that went. You don't default when you can print, and so it's just a matter of when are we going to print? When's the US going to sort of print the difference? And you're seeing the setup for that now. And the problem is the deficit's like kind of at a deficit blowing out, and you've got sort of receipts at an all-time high, and that receipts is propped up by tax receipts that are sort of an all-time high and employment an all-time low. And we've even seen the stat recently that sort of AI data center growth is overtaking consumer growth and propping that up as well. And so you've got sort of an income side of the balance sheet that's been propped up to all times high, an all time high that's quite sensitive. Whereas on the other side, you've got a whole lot of expenses that you can't touch. Like most of it's political dynamite. Not going to touch welfare or entitlements. The only thing that can touch is obviously trying to cut rates, which is why you've seen Trump just absolutely batter Powell. And that's what there's a recent piece by Gorian and Rosa Swag, and they're talking about this is not unprecedented to see a president just really pressure the hell out of the Fed chair, and that they'll keep pushing until they get their rate cuts, regardless of the employment outlook, inflation outlook. This has happened a few times in history. And there will be repercussions from it, and the repercussions are generally inflation. And yeah, that's kind of, I think it's not hard to arrive at that. Timing is always tough. Like, who knows when this will actually, it's a one big momentum trade. So you get run over if you try and short these things or get in front of them. So just to observe that it's unsustainable is fine. And as a result, I just want to hang out and hated stuff that's got decent cash flows, want a decent amount of exposure to real hard assets, and yeah, that's quite comfortable. Hold a little bit of cash in case I get some real crazy volatility and see some prices that I'd be pretty sad if I couldn't take advantage of them in some way. But that's that's kind of my overall outlook, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree with you on all that. I really would. Trader Ferg, I want to thank you so much for coming on. How do people find you? You're on Substack, writing pieces. What's your Substack? And I'll link to everything in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify.
Cheers, Andy. So Substack is substack.com. I just pretty much write what I'm doing with my portfolio. I send out a weekly email that's just the most interesting thing I've read, a podcast, a quote, chart, and something I'm sort of pondering in the markets. I don't really use Twitter anymore. I think the bots have taken over, which is a bit sad. It was an amazing platform when I first started using it. I guess not even Twitter anymore, X.
That's how I originally got in touch with you, was on X. It took me to touch you. You're not on it very much. It took you 2 weeks to get back to you.
I don't check this, especially the, you've got the messages and then you've got the the whatever the second layer of messages. And I've got to scroll through about 20 crypto bots for every real person.
I totally get it. Well, anyways, I want to thank you so much for your time. Again, I'll link to everything in the show notes, and love to have you on again soon.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's always a pleasure coming on.
Take care.